Welcome to Hot of the Cloud by Cloudonaut. We are your hosts, Andreas and
Michael Wittig.
And our weekly show is all about the latest AWS news and our recent experiences with building on AWS. On top of that, we are answering your questions at the end of the show. So use the hashtag AskCloudOnOut on Twitter or send us the direct message via LinkedIn. Or in case you're watching live, feel free to use the chat to ask your questions. So Michael, there were a lot of announcements this week, in the past week actually. I think we are really getting closer to reInvent. And so as always, we picked a few of them that are that we found interesting and that we want to go over together now. So what's the first announcement that caught your attention?
Yes, Andrea. So the first one that I picked is that CloudRail now supports what's called a delegated administrator, which basically means that you can enable the organization trail in a separate account that's not your root organization account. And this is very handy if you don't want anyone or not like at least a very small group of people to only have access to your org root account. While, for example, the security folks can use the security account to manage things like the CloudRail and organizational CloudRail. So that's a tiny change, at least for us, for users, but it is great in managing large deployments with many accounts.
Okay, Michael, so let me take over with the next one. So we have a new region open in Switzerland. So this is actually very close to where we live. So we both live in the south of Germany, so Switzerland is not too far away. So we are happy to have a new option nearby here, which is EU Central 2 in Switzerland, which is, by the way, a very nice country to travel to if you haven't done so.
That's right. So the only thing that I can imagine that is one of the most expensive regions, but I haven't checked the prices.
So yeah, that's maybe I didn't check the prices. Yeah. on the other hand, so if you ever plan to travel to Switzerland, it's very well known for chocolate and watches. I think so. So that's really
and cheese, right?
Cheese as well. Yeah. So yeah. Very nice little country with mountains and everything. Very cool. And now AWS is there as well with the region.
All right. So the next one that I had a look at is a new service, Andreas, and it is called Resource Explorer. And it actually does more or less what the name implies. It helps you to find your AWS resources in your AWS account. And the cool thing is that this works cross-region. So you can set it up in a way that you can search or basically get a few of all your resources from all your regions in a single account. It doesn't work cross-account yet, so there's no kind of org view of a resource explorer yet, but this is, I mean, one of the things that I would like to see in the future. The big problem, Andreas, with Resource Explorer is, I mean, you probably imagine you see everything in Resource Explorer, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
And turns out that's not the case. So it supports only some resource types. And I counted it. it includes resource types of 18 services. And I think we have over 200 services at the moment. So you can probably see the big problem of the announcement at the moment.
Yeah. So as always, this is really frustrating because all those services, when they are not working on all resources, they get almost, I wouldn't say totally useless, but I will never try to search a resource in there because I never know if the service is supported or not. So I think that's really unfortunate.
I mean, yeah, the problem is probably you use it a couple of times and then, I mean, if it doesn't find what you're looking for, you're not checking again in half a year probably if it's better or not. So yeah, but let's see. I mean, I hope they have a plan to add the other services to kind of convince them to integrate into that service as well.
Yes.
Let's see how that goes. I mean, the cool thing, or not cool thing, but the interesting thing is that we have similar services. Like there is a service or it's a capability called resource groups.
Mm.
It kind of does the same thing. It also lacks support for most of the services. And I hope that this is not becoming the same kind of thing. But what you can do with the service, Andreas, you can basically search by name, ID, or the ARM or even tags. And you can also customize this a little bit. So for example, if you don't want anyone to search on your tags or something, there is some way to kind of create views to protect maybe some tags that are not visible or values are not visible to everyone that has access to Resource Explorer. So that's it. And I think, Andreas, you have some like experience using it in the real world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so I just tried it this morning because one of my routines is that I check a few DynamoDB tables once a week. I know the table name very well, so I know exactly how the table is named, and I try to type that into the search bar. So I think what's important is one part of the service is integrated into the management console search bar. So you can search there for resources. And I tried to search for the DynamoDB table and I typed in the exact name. And the frustrating thing was the table did not show up. It showed me a huge list of Lambda functions that have similar things in their name. But really the resource that was really named exactly the search term that I used did not show up at all. So this was, I don't know, this is a little frustrating experience. So it seems like if you have many resources that start with the same or that use the same naming scheme and they all start with the similar name, that it's very hard to find one of those with the help of that. So yeah, it was useless for that activity. I looked into the service itself, the Resource Explorer. I opened up Resource Explorer, typed in my search query there. And then there was a huge list with resources with that name, and I found DynamoDB, the DynamoDB table in there. But I think in the management console, it just caps the number of results that it shows, and therefore it's not really usable for this situation. I think probably many are running into that because usually you use a naming scheme for naming your resources. So you will probably run into that as well. Okay, so I think, Michael, the next, I think this was probably the biggest announcement this week, is Amazon EventBridge launches a new scheduler. So a few episodes ago, we talked about that, and I think we even had a question from JJ, if I remember correctly, who was asking about how to implement a serverless scheduler for thousands of schedules and jobs. And our answer was, there is no really good way to do so. You need to implement that in yourself, and it's not that easy to get it right. So now the good news is we have a scheduler functionality built into EventBridge. Before that, we had the possibility to define an event rule, and you could have a schedule in there. But I think the problem with that is it was limited to, I don't know, a few schedules that you could have. So now with the scheduler functionality, we have a really scalable scheduler that scales to thousands or even more schedules. Of course, this comes with, if you have a highly scalable system, you often have that thing that it guarantees at least once event delivery to targets. So which means if you have, let's say, a scheduler that triggers a Lambda function once a day, it's possible that the scheduler does not trigger it only once, but twice or three times or in rare situations. So there's no guarantee that you have exactly once, it's at least once. So I think that's something you need to keep in mind when implementing by using the scheduler. Besides that, we have SQS dead letter queues. So in case the scheduler cannot invoke your target, which could be a Lambda function, SNS, topic, SQS, and many other AWS services, by the way, then you can use a SQS dead letter queue. Basically, then the scheduler sends the message it could not deliver to the queue, and you can pick it up from there. Yeah, so that's what I found out so far. I was a little confused about the infrastructure as code support. So I could not find the CloudFormation resources. Then you sent me a link to a resource in CloudFormation, which seems not, I don't know, probably it's not yet released. I don't know. I'm not sure about that. So it's not coming up when you search it in the documentation. It's not in the changelog, but there is already a page in the documentation with the CloudFormation resource. So it's probably coming soon. I don't know. And I could not find anything in Terraform yet, but it's probably only a few days until we get that. Yeah. So do you have any thoughts on the new scheduler, and do you think we can benefit from it?
Yeah, so the cool thing is that we can actually use it because we use something similar at the moment, and we implement it with step functions. So in our chatbot Marbot, we have a feature that when an alert arrives, we basically escalate this to the first user, and if the user does not acknowledge the alert within 5 minutes, we escalate to the second user. So this is a timer, 5 minute timer. Mm-hmm. And when we started, we implemented this with an SQS message with a delay. Mm-hmm. So we basically sent a message to an SQS queue and configured it in a way that it is delivered in 5 minutes. Then we switched to step functions, where we basically sleep for 5 minutes and then we invoke something. And now I think we can actually switch to the implementation that actually does what we want. It is kind of starting a timer for us, and this is great. And I think we should migrate this just for the sake of doing it. So there's no big benefit, but it's cool. Mm-hmm. So that's cool. One thing that I noticed because I looked into it, how hard the migration is. So we have first CloudFormation support is not yet fully rolled out. So I haven't tried it if I can deploy it, but the documentation is kind of, I mean, you can find it in Google, but it's not in the navigation bar, for example. So I think it's not fully rolled out there. So I haven't tried it, if it works actually or not. But the problem is that monitoring is actually not so easy. Mm-hmm. Because the only way to know that the timer kind of failed is that it shows up in the dead letter queue. But you can also have retries and things like that. And by default, it retries, I think, 185 times or something. And for 24 hours. So you only notice after 24 hours that something is wrong. So it would be cool if you could notice that before, right? I mean, you can definitely configure the retry. You can also like fail it faster and things like that. But yeah, I would like to see at least the CloudWatch metric or CloudWatch, in the RentBridge event, if a task fails. The other thing to notice is that this is not deployed to all regions. So keep that in mind. It is available in 9 regions. And I mean, I will not read the list because no one can really remember that. But check the region. Yeah. So if you're using, if you want to use this, it's not available in all the regions. I think we have 24 regions now, and it's only available in 9 of them. So yeah, I think that's what I have to say, Andreas. So let's go on to the next one, right?
Absolutely.
The next release is for the people using the ECS service, the Elastic Container Service, the orchestrator for containers on AWS. And what you can do now is you can prevent a task from being stopped due to, for example, a scaling event or a deployment. So for example, imagine, you mentioned that before, right, Andreas, in your installation of Mastodon, there is a sidekick worker. And it's really uncool to terminate the sidekick worker while it does something important. So what you want to do is you basically want to wait until it's kind of not working on any jobs, and then you will kind of do the deployment. And what you can do is basically you can use the container agent endpoint, and that's something, it's kind of, if you're from the EC2 world, then this is kind of the metadata service for containers. And it's kind of something reachable on a it's not really remote, it's kind of local, and you can invoke this API and basically tell it, okay, I'm working now, don't kill me. And you can set a timeout, basically, so how long this should be protected from a scale-in, and it goes up to 2 days, 48 hours. And then when you are done on working on the job, you can tell the API, okay, I'm done, I'm not protected anymore, please, if there's anything going on, scale-in or deployment, then do it now. And that's cool. And there's also like a real ECS API, like to, you can also do this remotely from the outside, but you can also do it from the inside. And that's pretty cool. So that's at least my thought. So Andreas, what do you think about this feature?
Yeah, so I think as you mentioned, it's very good to have that possibility because this was definitely missing and there were no good workarounds. So one thing that I'm not yet sure on how to get that right is, so if you have, for example, a worker that processes a job and you set the scale-in protection for that worker so that it can complete the job, what I don't know is how do you know basically when to release your scale-in protection. So let's say you block it for an hour and your worker runs and it picks new jobs from the queue. So how do you make sure it does not pick up new jobs but only work on those that is already working on so that you can complete the deployment? So that's what I'm thinking of. So assume you're doing a deployment and you have a task running. So how does the task know that it blocks the deployment? So that's a little...
I think that like the way to think about it is in the other way around. So what you will do is you will not block this for 1 hour. You will block it, you will start blocking it, you will do the job, and then you will unblock it. And before you pick up the next job, it either is killed or it still runs.
Yeah, but do you think that this is working? Because the question is, how often does ECS try to terminate the worker? Is it just...
I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
I think it probably will not work for small tasks. I mean, if your task kind of it requires a couple of milliseconds to work on, then I'm not sure if it's going to work.
But So the interesting thing is, if you, after an hour, finish the job and you release basically the thing, how long do you have to wait until you can plug it again? So this was my question. Yeah, I'm not sure. There is some events. I've seen that there are some ECS events that tell you when a deployment could not be executed because of scale-in protected tasks. But this doesn't really help as well. What would be really cool is if the agent API, the container agent API, would basically tell you, we tried to scale you down or replace you because of a deployment, but we could not. So this would be a cool state that we could have over the API. But yeah, but maybe something is coming up for that.
I see, yeah.
Okay, let me proceed with the last announcement on my list, which is RDS now supports the new general purpose GP3 storage volumes. So the new general purpose GP3 storage volumes that have been around since December 2020, so 2 years now. So it took 2 years until we get these new volume types with RDS. Amazing. What's the deal about those? So I basically reread my blog post that I've written 2 years ago about the GP3 volumes. And so first of all, general purpose means basically you have volumes that adapt to your workload. So you have with GP2, you have those burstable volumes that have a baseline capacity, and then you can burst beyond that. So that's a little different with GP3, because what you get there is you get the 3,000 IOPS, that is the burst, the maximum burst performance, is what you get with a GP3 out of the box. And then you can increase that throughput even higher by paying for the provisioned throughput, basically, then. So that's different than GP2 works. There, the volume size basically modifies the baseline and burst performance of your volumes. So those work a little different. So that is important to know. So in theory, it makes sense to switch from GP2 to GP3. Because you get the same performance, you get basically what the burst, the burst of GP2 is what you get as the performance of your GP3 volume. So that makes sense, at least for the smaller volumes below. I think the thing here is the 300, around 300 gigabyte. Because if you exceed that, you even get a little bit more bandwidth with GP2 volumes, but that's a detail that we maybe not have to mention here. And I think then the question is, so GP3 is basically a little it's a mixture of GP2 and then what we have as well is IO2, which is basically provisioned IOPS for your volumes. And the question then is, so if I can also provision my throughput for GP3 volumes, what's the difference to IO2 volumes then? And the answer to that is that IO2 volumes, and IO1 is probably the same, they really guarantee the throughput. So they guarantee that the bandwidth and the throughput is available to your storage from your instance. And with GPU3, there's no such guarantee. So you can provision that, and you will probably very likely get that throughput, but you don't have a guarantee for that. So I think that's the difference. And that also affects things like latencies and stuff. So actually, you are sharing the resource with more other customers, and yes, there's no dedicated capacity for that just for you. I think that's the main difference. And another difference between GP3 and IO2 is the durability of your data. So IO2 offers a higher durability. I don't know if that might be important or not, but that's how it is. That's the specification. So yeah, so we will link our blog post about GP3 volumes. I think it's an interesting read again when it comes now to RDS. And but then I looked into one interesting thing, which is the pricing. So EBS for EC2, GP3 is 20% cheaper than GP2. So the storage costs you 20% less when you switch from GP2 to GP3. That's significant. That's why many of those cost optimization consultants tell you should switch those volume types. But that's not true for RDS, because as far as I understood the pricing with RDS, GP3 costs the same, or even a little more, depending on what you have to provision additional to the baseline throughput, than GP2 volumes. So that's, I don't know why this is the case, but that's how it is. And what I also learned while I checked this is that RDS charges basically more for the storage than EC2 with EBS. So I always thought the only difference is in the instance type pricing, RDS compared to EC2, but that's not the case. It's also the storage that is costing you more with RDS than with EBS and EC2. Yeah. So I think in general, my advice is it might make sense to switch from GP2 to GP3 for smaller database instances, because you might benefit from the baseline performance. And also, I think what might be interesting is to use GP3 as an alternative to the more expensive provisioned instances based on IO1. Because the provisioned volume type IO2 is not yet available on RDS at all. So, yeah. So, but okay. If you have those running and you don't really need the full-blown enterprise guarantee volume types, then it might be an interesting alternative to use GP3 as an alternative to IO as well.
Okay, I see, Andreas. So, before we dive into what we learned, Andreas, last week, I have some interesting jobs that might be of interest to you if you are working in the AWS space, because as we all know, AWS expertise is in high demand. So what we have is that our partner TechRazor is hiring a cloud consultant, and the focus here is on machine learning and analytics. So if you're interested in things like S3, Athena, EMR, SageMaker, or any other machine learning or analytics service on AWS, then this is probably the right job for you. You can join TechRazor in Germany, so this is Hanover, Duisburg, Frankfurt, Hamburg, Munich, or in Vienna, Lisbon, or Lucerne. And our second partner is Demiken, and they are hiring a senior lead full-stack developer, and this is a remote position from Germany or the EU. So if you are expert in or want to become an expert in JavaScript, TypeScript, Node.js, and AWS, then this is something that you can check out in more detail. So you will find links to the positions in the show notes, and you can have get all the details there. So check that out if you're looking for something like that.
Yeah. So, and if you want to get an insight how it is to work at TechRazor and Demiken, you could check out our Builders Diary series, where we have guests in the show from both companies, and they share basically insights into their day-to-day work. So check that out as well if you're interested. Okay, Michael. So next, I want to quickly talk about a small thing that I learned last week. I learned it in a very painful way. So I'm using TerraGrant in one of our projects right now. And TerraGrant is basically a tool that simplifies rolling out Terraform, especially if you're using Terraform modules to different environments. So it's basically kind of a wrapper around Terraform. And with TerraGrant, you can have a hierarchy in your Terraform configuration files. So it's very common to have a folder called live, and then you have subfolders, for example, for different regions or different environments like test and prod and so on. So you build your hierarchy, and you can, in some extent, you can inherit basically properties from all these different levels in your project. And what I learned is there's a thing called TerraGrant HCL files, which is basically a configuration for TerraGrant. And what I didn't know is you can only inherit this configuration from one level above. So it doesn't matter how many levels you need to go up, but you can only inherit one file from basically the parent folders. And I added a new TerraGrant configuration file into another hierarchy in my folders. And this resulted in I did not have a Terraform remote configuration anymore, because it didn't pick up the file at the root level. And when I then run my pipeline, I was just every time starting with a fresh new Terraform local state, which meant I was creating all my resources every time I committed a change into my repository. And then I had to clean up everything because all those remote state files were lost because, GitHub Actions did not keep them. So this was a little frustrating experience. So important to know when you use TerraGrant, if you use those includes for your Terraform configuration, keep in mind that this works only for one level above. You can only include one other configuration file and not going through the whole hierarchy.
Okay, Andreas, I see. So we have one question in the chat so far, and this is from Jonas, and he basically asks if we see a big interest in the new and upcoming local zones. Because, for example, recently we saw new zones in Poland, Warsaw, and in Hamburg, Germany. And what he also adds is that they are like 35% more expensive, for example, the EC2 costs, compared to if you just go for the normal region. Mm. So do you have any insights into local zones, Andreas?
No. So actually, I didn't even know about the higher costs because I never looked into those local zones into detail, because I have no need for it. I don't have even an idea what I could do with it. So I understand that you use it to basically reduce the latencies to your clients as much as possible by deploying closer to the edge. But actually, I'm not deploying any workloads that are in need of that, so I didn't use it. I think it's not only the higher costs, you also have other problems because there are not all services available there and stuff. So it's basically EC2 and a few others. I never used it. Did you?
No, neither. I think we don't have a client using them. And I actually also don't get what they are good for. But I mean, there seems to be some interest in them because they continue to deploy.
So I understand that if you really, latency really, really matters and you have to optimize for every millisecond or even below that, then that's probably important. But okay, thank you very much. That's it for now. We will be back next week. In the meantime, subscribe to our newsletter, our podcast, or this YouTube channel to make sure you're not missing the upcoming shows. And of course, we want to thank our supporters who make this show possible. Please consider supporting our work as well with a recurring or one-time donation. You will find details and links in the show notes. Thank you very much for your attention. Thanks for listening and watching. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.